Welcome back to the program. In her time, she was the most powerful woman in the Western world. She was not afraid to use her feminine powers in ways that today would be considered politically incorrect. She was highly educated and sophisticated, the richest woman of her time, and her story would be the subject of propaganda and revisionism. She was Cleopatra, and although her story takes place over 2,000 years ago, many of her life themes are as contemporary as today's headlines. Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer Stacy Schiff has written a biography of Cleopatra that is just out in paperback. It is my pleasure to welcome Stacy Schiff back to this program to talk about Cleopatra, A Life. Stacy, thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Jeff.
It's great to have you here. First of all, talk a little bit about the process of writing a biography of someone without whom you had any kind of papers, any kind of voice to work with.
Yeah, I mean, that was the nutty part, wasn't it? There are no documents whatsoever. At best, we have one word of Cleopatra's. So what I essentially did was to immerse myself completely in everything written either about Egypt before her time, in everything she would have read, which was a big piece of it, and then in the accounts which are either contemporaneous to her or which post-date her. Everything we know about Cleopatra we know from Roman men who live later.
Right.
So a lot of this was reading those accounts and then figuring out who precisely those men were and whom they were writing for, because there are a lot of axes to be ground in that mix, let me tell you.
Of course, the other thing you were having to get through was the mythology that had grown up around her.
And, you know, that was something I hadn't counted on. The mythology about Cleopatra begins even in her day. She is the second great celebrity, if you would, after Alexander the Great. And she is demonized and mythologized in her own lifetime when she poses as a deity and comes across as this kind of shameless, grasping female. So you're cutting through not just Shakespeare and Elizabeth Taylor and Dryden and Shaw and all the modern interpretations, but also the propaganda of her own time.
Tell us a little bit about that time.
Well, you know, there are a number of great misconceptions that one has to overturn to look at Cleopatra properly. One of them, of course, is that she isn't Elizabeth Taylor and wasn't necessarily beautiful, but was in fact a very shrewd and strategic and well-educated woman. But the other is that Alexandria in Cleopatra's lifetime is still the center of the world culturally, economically, intellectually. And Rome, which is just coming into its own, is still a provincial backwater. So you have this, the world reversed from the way we think of it. Rome is just this kind of muddy, half-built, jerry-rigged, somewhat unenlightened city, and Alexandria is the sumptuous city of long, great boulevards and blinding marble buildings, and it was the city to which you went if you wanted a book or a tutor or a doctor or a poison or a master craftsman. It was really the city of opulence and education.
And of course, Cleopatra's reign was one that came and went several times during her lifetime.
One of the beauties of working with a subject like this are the vicissitudes of her fortune. She comes to power. She is immediately embroiled in a civil war with her brother, and she's exiled. And that's where, in fact, I open the book, where she's exiled in the desert, about to really be clobbered by her brother and his troops. She has raised a small mercenary army of her own. This is just as Caesar arrives. So she unexpectedly wins that war against the brother. She and Caesar will then form an alliance, which looks to be an unbeatable one, but then, of course, Caesar is murdered. So it's kind of back and forth and back and forth. And then after the Roman civil wars finally deliver up Mark Antony as the likely heir to Caesar, Cleopatra will ally herself with Mark Antony, which will prove not to have been such a great idea several years later. Right. So it's very much a life of ups and downs and of fortunes gained and reversed.
And, of course, these alliances involve interpersonal aspects as well as the political aspects. She has, what, a child with Caesar and three children with Mark Antony.
You put that so delicately. Yes, she has this amazing ability to, you know, is it coincidence that she happens to fall in love with, so to speak, or have children with the two most powerful Roman commanders of the day? She has a son with Caesar, the only son he will ever have, who is therefore this half-divinely Egyptian child, half-Roman child. And then she'll have a set of twins and another son with Mark Antony. Both these men are married to other women for most of the time that they're involved with Cleopatra. And both of these alliances are, of course, furthered by those mutual families, especially as Cleopatra's power to some extent derives from her posing as a kind of maternal figure, as a fertility goddess. So the fact that she is turning out these heirs to the throne is a very, very fortuitous thing.
And in that is part of the reason, as you explain, that Caesar writes very little about Cleopatra.
You know, Caesar's memoirs, so to speak, are a very puzzling collection of writings. But yes, he mentions Cleopatra precisely once, and essentially applauds her for having been an obedient female. But he had no real reason to advertise this alliance. She's a foreign woman. A Roman couldn't marry a foreigner. She hails from a place that is thought of in Rome as a very decadent and somewhat dubious address, which was Egypt. And as valuable as this alliance was to him, he had no real reason to advertise it in Rome, especially as he's married to his good, straight-spined Roman wife. So that is fairly easily explained. What's less explained or explicable is why Cleopatra travels to Rome with their mutual child. And in fact, she's in Rome when Caesar is murdered on the Ides of March. We don't really have an explanation as to why she makes that trip.
Talk a little bit about the politics of the time between her and the Romans.
It's a very odd relationship in that, economically speaking, the power is with Egypt. Cleopatra has a vast fortune. She is the richest person, man or woman, in the Mediterranean at the time. And hers is the most fertile country in the Mediterranean. She is largely feeding Rome. However, Rome is the military power. And as we all know, Rome is intent on conquest, is busy gobbling up the eastern Mediterranean. And Egypt is one of the few countries, at the point when Cleopatra is in power, one of the few countries that Rome has not yet managed to take over. So there's a very tender balance here where Rome very much would like for Egypt to remain stable because it relies on its on the food supply. Cleopatra would obviously like for Egypt to remain autonomous, but she needs to be able to curry favor in Rome while at the same time not offending her people, her subjects, by too much currying favor with Rome. So it's a very delicate balancing act at both ends. And of course, at the end of her lifetime, she will lose that. That balancing act will be overthrown, and Egypt will be annexed to Rome by Octavian and will lose its autonomy until the 20th century.
But she did such a great job during her time of balancing these competing interests. I mean, this was pre-Machiavelli that she understood this.
That's what's so remarkable, because that balancing act had been one that her father had essentially spent his life addressing, not altogether successfully, but back and forth to Rome with all kinds of offers, with all kinds of solicitations. It had been very difficult for him. And Cleopatra manages to do in a matter of weeks by essentially seducing Caesar, or setting up with Caesar anyway, what it took her father years to do in terms of ingratiating herself with Rome. And then throughout the ups and downs of the Roman Civil War, she manages to step aside at the right times, to engage herself at the right times, and to play these two men, Caesar and Mark Antony, two very different men, beautifully to her own ends. She gets them to do her bidding in many ways, including eliminating several of her siblings who are competitors to the throne. So until the very end, yes, she has this amazingly shrewd ability to back the right horse and to see to it that what she needs done is done.
Was that an accident, or did that come from something in her upbringing, her education, her skills?
Well, we know a good deal about how Cleopatra was educated, and it was a top-notch Greek education, precisely the education that Caesar or Cicero or Mark Antony would have received. And she was clearly, oddly enough, Ptolemaic Egypt is very egalitarian in terms of women, so she was very much groomed as a potential heir to the throne. What's interesting is that there are a number of siblings, there are four siblings, and she is the one who prevails, which was not preordained. So I do read in that a certain testimony to her cleverness and to her determination. Any one of those siblings could have been the one to claim the throne. She manages, one sibling is killed by the father when she tries to usurp the throne, in fact, and the others are pretty much done away with by Cleopatra herself. So I do read a certain ruthlessness there, but also a real mind for strategy, that she's able to sort of work the entire family around to her own ends.
The combination of the strategy and the savagery of the politics at the time really come together around her.
Yes, they make modern politics seem very docile, don't they? There's a lot of assassinating of siblings and poisoning of siblings and butchering of siblings. Yeah, there's a tremendous, it's not unusual for an ancient dynasty, but it is a particularly bloody history, I will admit. And if you look at it, Plutarch has a wonderful line where he basically says this kind of thing was standard operating procedure, and it was the kind of thing that happens in the best of families. So if you look at it in context, it seems a little bit less gory, but it is a rather bloody history.
How did Cleopatra fit into the role of other women at the time?
Well, there you have a real divide between Rome, what Rome thought was proper for a woman, and what Egypt thought was proper for a woman. Rome, as we all know, was a very masculine culture, was a very military culture. Women were largely invisible in intellectual life. Women had no rights. Women didn't vote. A good woman had three children, or had children, and brought them up in a very understated but beautifully devoted way. An Egyptian woman, and this was true centuries before Cleopatra, had rights which were really rather startling. She could inherit property. She could run a business. She could divorce a husband. She could enter a marriage into her own. It's been estimated that a third of Cleopatra's Egypt was actually in female hands. So by those standards, what Cleopatra does is not all that startling, in the sense that there are women who are educated, who are businesswomen, who hire flute players and own barges and do all kinds of things that we think of as being rather male. There had been previous Ptolemaic queens as well, so she had plenty of role models. The difference is that Cleopatra rules by herself. And those earlier queens had male consorts, either for part of their reigns or for all of their reigns. Cleopatra pulls this act off entirely on her own.
She rules with her brother for a period of time.
Okay. Yes, the two of them inherit the throne on the death of the father, jointly, which is interesting. It's not clear why he left the throne to the two of them. She's much older. She's 18, he's 10. They're entitled married, in fact, at this point, although that seems to have been in name only. And as I said, within a matter of months, they are engaged in a civil war. So it was hardly a happy collaboration. And the same thing will happen again. That brother will be killed in the civil war against Cleopatra. At the end of the civil war, Caesar is there, and he will put her back on the throne. But he will do so with her other younger brother, because it was seen that she needed a male consort. A queen had to have a male consort of some kind. And so again, a younger brother is put on the throne with Cleopatra, and he will conveniently disappear from the story. It's said that she poisoned him, although we don't know that for certain.
Mm-hmm. Why is there so little contemporaneous writing about her?
I think there the answer is that the victor gets to tell the story. We tend to forget she's one of history's losers. So there are few people who are willing to rally to sing her praises, since she has lost to Rome. And it's Rome that's writing the history. As I say, I mean, this is all coming to us from Plutarch, from Suetonius, from Appian. Roman men didn't have a good word, really, to say about Cleopatra. She is the defeated. Egypt is a land of decadence and of dubious morals. There's not a lot there that anyone really wants to applaud. It's an irony, because she was immensely well-educated, and her family were immensely history-oriented. So there would have been a tremendous number of volumes. There would have been a great family history. There would have been archives of all kinds. There would have been day-to-day documents. There would have been a tremendous amount of paperwork, for lack of a better word, about her reign, all of which has been lost largely to the Alexandrian humidity. No papyrus from her time has survived. So we have a double loss because of the climate and because of the fact that she goes down as the defeated in history.
And even Plutarch's writing is so much later.
Plutarch is writing 100 years after Cleopatra. So he is recycling stories that he has heard from his grandfather. And despite that distance, he is the closest chronicler, really, to Cleopatra. And he's also the least biased. so I tended, when working on this book, to take his word over someone else's. Lucan is closer in time, for example, the Roman poet, but he was very much using her as a symbol of the decadent East,
mm-hmm.
And as a sort of conniving woman. And he's very over the top, and he's writing poetry. So I tended to pretty much discount anything he had to say.
As you mentioned a moment ago, the Romans created this whole propaganda story about her, which also clouds some of the history.
Well, there's a wonderful quirk here in the story as well. Essentially, Octavian, who is Caesar's great-nephew, adopted great-nephew, and Mark Antony, his famed protege, will face off. And Cleopatra, of course, is allied with Mark Antony. The Roman civil wars have been going on for decades. No Roman feels like fighting another civil war. So to pass off this next phase of the civil war as a foreign war, Octavian will turn his battle against Mark Antony into a battle against Cleopatra, that foreign seductress. And he therefore creates with her this kind of grotesque, this, you know, crazed Eastern despot. And that is where the propaganda really, really begins to set in, because he will turn Cleopatra into a larger-than-life figure in order to energize his troops, to entice his troops into a war that he paints as a foreign war, which was in fact, of course, a war against his compatriot Mark Antony.
The mythology that has grown up around her is even being Egyptian as opposed to Greek.
Exactly, another misconception which I should have addressed. Yes, we think of her as Egyptian by birth. She is in fact Greek Macedonian. She's descended from one of the generals of Alexander the Great, and by culture, by language, by education, she's a Greek. And it's very often said of her family that they were honey-skinned. They were not dark-skinned. She is the first of her dynasty even to speak Egyptian, the language of the people over whom she rules. And Greek would have been the language of her court, of her day, of her administration.
The stories are even confusing and conflicting about her death.
Yeah, the death is fascinating, because the death seems, Cleopatra's death was a perfect subject for the portrait painters. You know, you have this extraordinarily opulent scene in which a woman does herself in ostensibly with a snake. No early chronicler actually mentions a snake and says, here's how she killed herself, it was with a snake. Plutarch and Strabo both say very, very clearly, we don't know how she died. But the we don't knows give way to the much more forceful imagery. She clearly must have poisoned herself. There had to be a way to, there was no other way to kill a woman and her two handmaidens in a closed room, and she surely knew her poisons. But the snake creeps into the story. The snake is the symbol of Egypt. The snake tends to wind itself around the Isis statues, which are the deity with whom Cleopatra associates herself. The snake parades through the streets of Rome in the triumph over Cleopatra along with her statue. And the snake was a great gift to the portrait painters because, you know, after Eve and Medusa, women and snakes go back a long way. So it's a very convenient metaphor, but it probably had no real place in her story.
How did she go out? What do we think is the real story?
My guess is that she's in a closed room. She's in a mausoleum that she's built for herself. And she's been told that she's about to be transported back to Rome, where she will be paraded through the streets as war booty, which is about as humiliating as it gets. And after that procession, she would have been put in a dungeon in Rome, which is what had happened to other Hellenistic sovereigns. So clearly she needs to end her life. And as I say, every Hellenistic sovereign of the time knew his or her poisons intimately. It would not have been difficult for her to figure out what to kill herself with. Someone simply had to get her the means with which to do so. And from the scene, assuming Plutarch is giving us an accurate scene, it's clear that whatever she used didn't cause convulsions, wasn't terribly painful. It was a fairly peaceful death. So my guess is it was some kind of poison that she administered. Her handmaidens seem to have died of the same cause, and they set the scene very elaborately. It's slightly different in the two accounts we have of it in Dio or Plutarch, but it's clear that the scene was, as always with Cleopatra, very carefully staged, and that she realized that she was at the end of the road, and this was the way to end things.
And it also came at a time when the world itself was changing or about to change very profoundly.
It's very sobering to realize that this is precisely 30 years before the birth of Christ. There is this, throughout her lifetime, there is this spiritual longing in the air. There is this sense that the world is in transition. There is a sense that people are eager to embrace some kind of deities, and that there's a hunger for a unified world in some way. And this had been the dream, of course, of Caesar, of Mark Antony and Cleopatra, if not Caesar and Cleopatra, that East and West might somehow be united. So yes, it's one of those moments where you can see the world really very clearly in transition.
Stacy Schiff, the book is Cleopatra Life. It is just out in paperback. Stacy, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Jeff.